how the other half lives. We'll see how we get around. Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke. That means you're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Time in the U.S., and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KBF 88.3 FM is located, or the east side of New Orleans, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available of this show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Larry Bogad, who's got quite an interesting set of stories for us. He's written two books. One of them's reissued. One of them's brand new. One of them's called Tactical Performance. The other, Electoral Guerrilla Theater. He's out at University of California at Davis, and I don't know how they're keeping him there because this is some wild books. Larry, welcome to Wade's World.
Thank you so much, Wade. It's an honor.
So what is Electoral Guerrilla Theater? I mean, I think that's the 2016 campaign, right?
That's it. I mean, it is an unbelievable theater. What I mean by that term is when activists or creative artists run for political office, not because they think they can win, but to get a lot of attention and make a point. It's basically using the election system as sort of a radical prank. To call attention to the fact that actually, if you don't have millions of dollars and heavy sponsors, it's really hard to win, as we've found. So I have examples in that book of all kinds of pranksters who have an issue. They human rights issue, civil rights issue. They want to get it out there, but they want to use the election system because there's a lot of media attention towards it.
Well, I thought there was an interesting story in your book about, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this, kabouters in Amsterdam in the 1970s.
Kabouters.
Kabouters, okay.
That's right.
Who and what were they? What were they up to?
They were eco-anarchists. They were like a nonviolent grassroots group of merry eco-anarchists. And there they are in Amsterdam in 1968, 69, 70. And there's a housing crisis. There's a lot of pollution. There's a lot of problems that they want to address. So they decided to tell the country that they were actually gnomes. Kabouter means gnome in Dutch.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, just so you know, right?
I may have missed that in my quick reading, but okay, good.
Yeah, totally. It's like, impress your friends at a party. They're a gnome.
A little Dutch. Here's what I know. I know what a gnome is.
I think it's one of the few words I remember in Dutch now. But, so the thing is that gnomes have a really happy place in Dutch folklore. So they were able to take this very happy thing that people associate with being told bedtime stories, as a kid, and make it an eco-anarchist symbol. And they were like, yeah, we're the gnomes. Like the gnomes in the fairy tales, we want to help the environment. We want to help people, So it was a very friendly face for their radical movement, which was a legit, positive movement. They wanted to do good things. But they were so charming. They ran for office, not expecting to win.
And they actually won some seats, as I could tell.
It blew their minds and everyone else's when they won 5 seats in the Amsterdam City Council.
Watch out. Look out.
Exactly. Now what do we do? I love that story in that they got more success than they were prepared for. And to be honest, it did cause some problems because they're anarchists. What are they going to do with all this power? And they did figure it out along the way, but they did have arguments along the way. But at the same time, they managed to actually, perhaps might surprise people, they got some really positive things done while they were trying to figure it out, while they were half in shock for their 4-year term.
Well, you compared them, interestingly, to something called the Best Party in Reykjavik, Iceland, that also won a good number of seats and decided, well, by God, we'll step up somehow and try to really govern.
Absolutely. And that's a great and much more, as you point out, a much more recent example where, you know, a stand-up comedian, Jon Nahr, over there, you know, this is during the period of just a few years ago of the Icelandic total economic collapse, you know, and everyone, there's great discontent, civil disobedience in Iceland, people like blockading the parliament, things like that. And here comes this wacky, you know, and quite sincere and heartfelt guy who has a great sense of humor. He's a professional comedian. And him and his friends say, oh, we are the best party. Vote for us because we're the best. And they were very silly and lighthearted, but actually had some serious points as well. They mixed it together. And he became the mayor of Reykjavik. And they took over the city council. They were even more than the Kabouters, in other words. And, you know, they had a pretty good run. And they, yeah, difficult times, but because they were this great combination, which I like, of serious and silly, you know, they called it anarchist surrealism was their, like, motto. But
well, and we're seeing some of that in Italy. Isn't there something, a guy who's a comedian whose party, now I can't remember, I want to say five something, I think their candidate actually led in the first primary for mayor of Rome.
Yeah, I heard about that, but I, to be honest, I don't remember, you know, the details of that one.
And it's gone in and out. I mean, we actually work in Rome, but it's more on housing issues. I haven't followed this closely. But this is interesting in terms of your theory about, I mean, to the degree that electoral guerrilla theater is now becoming what real elections are about. What does that do to all of your work, Larry?
Well, that's funny you mention that. My dad was like, electoral guerrilla theater, so that's like Trump, right?
Exactly. I mean, I was just like holding off on that one. But and I don't know how someone outdoes Trump now. If we had something like this going on in the U.S., I mean, what a candidate trying to prank Trump, I mean, how do you go there?
Right. I mean, he like Spinal Tap, he already goes to 11. You know, you can't go any higher on the speaker. So, yeah, Trump is almost impossible to exaggerate. But, yeah, what do you do when it becomes this crazy circus? And Trump himself, you know, as a performance studies guy myself, I look at him, I'm like, right, he has training not only in reality TV stuff, but also, if we remember, in professional wrestling. He was dabbling in that. And you can totally see that as he's egging people on to fight other people, et cetera. You know, that's his professional wrestling chops right there as the bad business guy character. So he's mixing reality and reality TV and crazy fiction. So you got to find other ways. You know what I mean? Like, I think you get, as the target shifts, you know, the target of your satire, you got to study them really closely. You have to respect what they are doing, even if you don't like them, enough to really study them so you can find some weak spots. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the whole point of tactical variety. And that's part of, obviously, what you're arguing, I think, in your tactical performance book.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that, Wade, because it is. It's like you got to think about, all right, you can't just keep doing the same thing. You know, in tactical performance, I try to say, you know, conventional protest is great. You need it. You have to have people doing, you know, demonstrations and picket lines, et cetera. But how can you mix it up? How can you make it a little more creative and compelling so that people who usually ignore that stuff or are turned off by it might go a little bit towards your side or even join up, you know?
Or as we've always, we trained organizers for the last, you know, 45 years, if you don't change the tactic, the opponent absorbs that tactic. I mean, the impact and repetition is not the mother of, is the mother of study for the target as well as for the organization if you don't alter the tactic. But a lot of what you're talking about is agitprop, is different ways of making the action more lively and effective, right?
Absolutely, and I would agree with you, man. It's you got to learn from your opponent. They're like your dance partner. They make a new move, you got to keep doing the same move. You know, so it's almost like you're working not together, but you're getting better at your job by paying attention to how they're doing their job. You know, if you do a street blockade and people go up on tripods to block the street, right? And then the police say, and this is something that actually happened, eventually they kept blocking the streets, you know, like reclaim the streets, our street parties. And then the police were like, we could put little wheels on the bottom of these tripods that just wheel the person away and deal with them later. You got to hand it to them. That's a clever idea. So it's like, okay, well, what's the next idea? also, I think it's important, and in the book, Tactical Performance, I talk about, like, anything from making a picket line more creative and fun to be part of and more interesting to the media so that people like you and what you're doing and why you're going on strike or why you're doing a boycott. You know, make it fun, but also tell your story. I got a story to tell. So that's the kind of local thing, but there's also big media pranks. Like, I worked with the Yes Men on a number of fake newspapers.
I got to meet the Yes Men in one of their pranks. Luckily, I wasn't pranked because I knew it. I mean, it somehow didn't add up, and I think they were being overly generous to me, but... it was right after Katrina, and they were making a big point about, you know, money that wasn't being given and, you know, basically pranking Bush. And it was all of a sudden I get calls of, hey, you know, you're on HBO because they did a show on HBO and they were in my office. And luckily I just sort of never got it. I mean, it wasn't adding up, but they were very effective. Are they still at it?
Oh, yeah, they're still doing their thing, you know. And I think it's great. I worked with them for a few years, basically, a number of years ago, and had a blast with it. You know, these are the big media spectacles, you know, the interventions that, you know, you impersonate a big corporate head, and just for a little while you say the things that guy should be saying. You know, they call it identity correction, which I think is clever, you know, not identity theft, because it reveals itself. You never leave a lie on the table is the motto. So, you know, you do a prank like that, like maybe what you were experiencing there in New Orleans, right? But the point is not to really fool someone. It's just like for a few seconds, you kind of make them go, huh? Wait. And then you get to have the pleasure of figuring it out or being like, ah, okay, I get your point.
Well, it's more like a candid camera moment. We're talking to Larry Bogad, who's written a couple of interesting books and been involved in tactical and guerrilla tactics and in the electrical and other spheres. How do we distinguish the sort of fun, progressive nature of the Yes Men from the destructive right-wing side of a James O'Keefe and his sort of, I think he thinks of himself as a journalist, for God's sake. So I don't think the Yes Men were ever confused about that. But what is the distinction there?
I think it's a really basic ethical distinction. Again, when I've worked with the Yes Men or other groups, you know, we've created groups like the Oil Enforcement Agency that pretends to be, you know, enforcing, you know, getting people off of oil addiction, you know?
Right.
We do these kind of funny things that at first seem real. Again, you never leave a lie on the table. It is like a quick, playful guerrilla theater.
There's a wink to it.
There's a wink to it where exactly, that's a perfect way of saying it, Wade. It's like, you're going to figure it out, I guarantee you, within 3 to 12 seconds or whatever, you know.
Right.
The idea, I like to think of it as a little bit of synaptic misfire. Like, I'm just going to make your synaptic network go, hey, wait a minute, this is not the usual thing, what's happening here? And then you get to enjoy knowing, oh, I get it, it's a political gag, I understand. As you said, it's like a radical, progressive, candid camera. I like how you said that. Whereas someone like O'Keefe is they're liars. You know, he gets someone like...
Well, and I think the other thing about the Yes Men and other groups like that is they're live without a net. I mean, they're calling real media to come to what turns out to be a fake press conference, or they're walking into a bank. You know, the kind of stuff they do is not going to be edited. It's either going to die or rise right there on the scene. But O'Keefe, and part of where he keeps running into, crossing every line, you know, is he just sort of makes it up as he goes along. He may do something, but he films and then makes the film something different than what the facts were. That's not a Yes Men tactic, is it?
It is absolutely not, and I'm glad you make that. It's an important distinction. In other words, even our pranks reflect our values and our politics. And they are pranks, but you're not going to walk away actually confused about what was reality. You know what I mean? We did a guerrilla musical in a healthcare conference. Basically, they were having their healthcare conference to try to prevent Obamacare, you know, healthcare insurance corporations. You know, so all these insurance corporations, like, how do we stop Obamacare? And all of a sudden, some of the very nicely dressed people start standing up and singing a musical. And the song was critical of them and was advocating a public option. And it was using a song from the musical Annie tomorrow, okay? So all of a sudden everyone's singing, and the insurance guys are like, what's going on? But after the first few seconds, you knew what was happening. It was playful, and that became a media stunt that got covered quite well on CNN, MSNBC. But that's more our style. Even when we're kind of transgressing and trespassing and doing things like that, it's playful. We want to be charismatic. We want to get people on our side through the ideas, you know what I mean? And, yeah, someone who just edits things to make say something that they didn't really say, hey, that's not what we're about.
Well, when you mentioned singing, the first time I ever went to what they call a deputation in Toronto, they were fighting privatization of a water company, and we'd been involved in a similar campaign in New Orleans. And this was before we started building Acorn Canada. But all of a sudden, after I spoke, there were these singing grannies, as they call themselves. And I thought, what is that? And I've seen them now, you know, now I'm, you know, 15 years later, I've sort of, you know, seen and done what there is in Canada. And they're very common throughout Canada, although I don't think they're as common elsewhere in the world. You must be familiar with them.
Totally. The Raging Grannies. You know, you got Raging Grannies in New York, and it's in some places in the States as well, like in California.
Oh, okay.
See why, you know, but you can see why it's such a great idea and a great movement. It's like, we're not so great to our old people, first of all, in both societies. Worse here, I would say, you know, and they don't necessarily get the visibility or the attention. And then also, they know that because of their age, they can leverage that to get some more attention when they do something unexpected. When we have, again, the idea is to
be... These are often young people in costume, right?
Yes, for sure. But then you also have, I'll tell you, there was a group of senior citizen grannies, like the Raging Grannies, in New York. And maybe you heard about this, but they went to the Times Square Military Recruiting Center at the height of the Iraq War, you know, when the most people were involved in it. And they said, we want to enlist. So this is like hardcore. They said, we want to enlist, and we're not leaving until you take us, instead of some nice young boy or girl who might get killed in Iraq. We're very old, and we're willing to go and sacrifice our lives instead of these nice young people.
Interesting.
And the military recruiter's like, can you leave, please? And they refused to leave, and it turned into this symbolic civil disobedience,
mm-hmm.
where they did get arrested. You know, there was a whole court case that was going to happen. So I thought that was a beautiful intervention, too, you know, like understanding that, you know, when you're a bit older, hopefully you're going to get a little more respect and a little more attention because it's not expected that you're going to do this stuff.
Well, and I know being on the West Coast, you have to be familiar with the Ruckus Society, and they're sort of very wide open activity around tactics, particularly environmental, but also on other issues. I know they showed up at different times to lend a hand to Acorn back in the days, and how does that fit in with all this same theory?
I mean, they're so great. You know, they're so skilled at what they do, and they understand how to do direct action, you know, be it the you know, blocking a drilling station.
Oh, their mosquito fleet last year in Seattle was outstanding. I actually, John Sellers was on this, on Wage World talking about it. John, you know, hasn't retired. He's not with Ruckus anymore, but he's still ready to jump in. But they do some stuff that's pretty scary. I mean, climbing up buildings, and you know, they put a poster up for us in Chicago once that was way higher than I wanted to ever go. But
probably higher than I would want to go too.
I hear you. But they're very effective, I think, in different situations.
Absolutely, and you know, they respect what they're doing and those safety issues. You know, what I love is how professional they are. They do trainings that are really serious. They take it super seriously. They all know what they're doing. They understand the risks they're taking, but they also know how to do that climbing and all the different things. So I think it's great. They take the craft seriously, and they also take the art seriously. You know what I mean? Like the art of protest. So they're able to do these physical things like the blockades,
mm-hmm.
banner hangs and things. But they really think about, okay, what's the story we're telling? How are we going to, you know, explain to people what this corporation's doing and why we need to stop it? So they tell the stories.
We're talking to Larry Bogad today, who's written a couple of books, one called Tactical Performance and the other called Electoral Guerrilla Theater. Larry, you actually are a professor, teach somehow at the University of California and have a center that looks into all this. Who in the world, what is it about them that they're allowing you to do this? But who are you looking at across the table? Are these people who want to get in theater? Are these potential political organizers and activists? I mean, what's the who do we want to read this book and to show up at your classroom?
Well, I tell you, I've really enjoyed teaching at the University of California at Davis. I'm grateful that they let me in. my students, who I absolutely adore, you know, I'm in the theater and dance department.
I was curious about that. Okay, so it's theater and dance. It's not political science then.
That's right. That's right. But I am the one guy who does this kind of thing in the department, but they're very tolerant of me, you know. they accept it. The students I get range from theater students who want to get a little more political, make an intervention on their favorite issue out there in the world. We just last week had about 11 student projects on campus where they did guerrilla theater based on a lot of different issues, ranging from student debt. We had some Disney princesses singing about their debt, which was a wonderful guerrilla musical action. I was so proud. And then some students who just confused the local homophobic preachers that come to campus and shout their hatred at the students. So we had some students, their guerrilla theater was to just throw them off and confuse them, which was wonderful. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud of those students. And I also do workshops around the country and around the world. I did one recently in Latvia where Latvians wanted to do stuff about homophobia in their society and also the Russification of the culture, things like that. So I just enjoy having people take what they're passionate about and having them realize their creativity can be channeled into a nice, direct, creative action that will get free out there.
And in some cases, I know your book also deals with very interesting sort of individual actions that some people have been able to perfect in this. I mean, Super Barrio in Mexico City is famous. I mean, I was lucky enough to be with a group that spent a day with him going around the barrio. Very interesting. You talk about that. And Muhammad Ali, in some ways, without the mask, had that kind of impact too. How does that shake in terms of not part of a social movement, but certainly has an impact?
Totally. I mean, well, that's an incredible way that you got to meet him and see him in his context, Super Barrio, doing his thing.
We were very lucky.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how lucky at the time, but yeah.
I get it, but... Well, you know, I think both of these folks, you know, they're using sports, they're sports people, right? And then leveraging that celebrity to shed light on other issues. The distinction I guess I would make between Muhammad Ali and Super Barrio, not that one's better than the other, obviously. Muhammad Ali inspired so many people. He was a professional athlete and, you know, had his political consciousness, you know, change as he got a little bit older. Super Barrio kind of started out as a lucha libre professional wrestler, and from the get-go, he's performing, and he's like the hero of the poor people in the neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think right from the get-go, he's almost more of a grassroots celebrity and a neighborhood-based, you know, celebrity, which is wonderful, you know, and it's a great symbol for not just Mexican folk people or Mexican-American people, but everyone can take that on and celebrate that. We did a big labor action way back in New York before I moved to California, and we were working with the Immigrant Labor Coalition to call attention to sweatshops in New York, and many of the people were from Mexico. And we did basically a lucha libre wrestling in the street, and we used the image of Super Barrio. One of the labor organizers put on a Super Barrio costume, and it was almost like he's here with us, you know? So it's almost like a Spartacus kind of thing. So we had our Super Barrio, inspired by the original, in New York City doing professional wrestling outside of sweatshops to embarrass them, you know? And it was good fun.
Well, and your point about Ali is certainly correct, but, you know, the way he used poetry, if you want to call it that, and humor was part of how he was able to deliver the sting of some of what he had to say about race and poverty and war. So he's got to be somewhere close to your line.
For sure. And he said, like, early in his life, he saw a great I forget the guy's name, but a professional wrestler that was both really good at what he did and charismatic and funny. And he said, "Oh, that guy's great." Like, he actually learned a little something from wrestling. About, hey, have your character, have your persona, have your personality out there. And so he did revolutionize that for boxing.
Well, and his magic tricks as well. I mean, he carried those everywhere, no matter how, I mean, they weren't great tricks, but he wanted you to see something past, you know, the fighter and warrior. And that's a tactical adaptation that a lot of people, you know, probably haven't thought through as much as they should. At the same time, you know, some of these things you have to be careful, and you and as organizers, we're always making sure that the tactics don't overwhelm the organization. And in some cases, my argument has been that was part of the Achilles heel in the Occupy movement, is that the tactic of occupying almost swallowed the action itself. But you make a couple of good points about Greenpeace in Peru and the pie throwing at Rupert Murdoch, which, you know, are worth sharing, I think.
Right, yeah, you know, I mean, the pie-throwing thing, you know, and it's all with respect. I think we learn from mistakes, and it's important to be honest and reflect on
it. It's a real world out there.
Yeah, you know, this is how we get better. So there was an event where Rupert Murdoch was up in Parliament, actually in trouble, getting grilled for malfeasance of his, you know, terrible newspapers and terrible journalists.
Well, you know, hacking phones, you know, yeah. And including people dying and paying off. I mean, he was, you know, it was nasty work. That paper ended up having to be killed. But at the same time, the tactic was what?
Well, a comedian guy got up there and tried to pie him in the face while he's getting grilled by Parliament. And his wife bought the pie, and the guy got arrested. The thing is, what was wrong, the reason you would pie someone is to call attention to something that's not being paid attention to. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like a big business guy, and everyone thinks he's okay. You pie that guy, you know, and then people say, why did you do that? And you can then explain it. In this moment, we know what he's doing. The whole world, or whatever, the whole country, is watching him having to deal with getting grilled for what he did. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're actually interrupting that now and calling attention to your pie thing. Like, you're actually, it's the reverse of what you should be doing.
A very important point, I thought. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure I'm on solid ground here, but it almost killed that tactic. I'm trying to remember over the last couple of years since then if we've seen much of that kind of activity anymore.
It's a good point, Wade. I can't think of one either. It may have happened. I'm just not sure. And I do think it did discredit, at least in that moment, you know. And, you know, the guy probably had good intentions. He claimed he did.
But it's always a difficult tactic if it somehow inadvertently makes you sympathize with the target. It sort of takes that wink and humor out of it, which I think in terms of the clownesque and carnivalesque themes that you argue are so important, aren't they?
Well, we started an army of clowns back when I was teaching in England before I came back to America. We started an army of clowns for protest specifically for this reason. Like, disarm the opponent with the unexpected and playful imagery while still getting your point across. It's important, even when you're like the rebel clown, funny protester. Now, once you have all the media on your, you know, paying attention to you, you got to make your political point. You can't just let it just be silly, you know? And so, yeah, the pie thing backfired. And I think it's important to match the tactic to the situation. And you were getting at this, Wade. You know, you don't want to confuse a tactic with a strategy. You know?
Well, we used to argue you don't kill a squirrel with an elephant gun. But, you know, there are no good metaphors, but the point's still the same. Look, Larry, how can people get their hands on either one of these books? Why don't you give people some information about that?
For sure. One way is just to go to my website, which is lmbogad.com, or larrybogad.com gets you to the same place. Last name spelled B-O-G-A-D. And then I have all that stuff right there. Or you can just look online wherever you buy books. Hopefully it'll get out into some political bookstores soon, these books. But, yeah, that's basically the best way.
So Amazon, or can I get it through Routledge, or...?
Absolutely. I mean, if you go to Routledge.com and just put in my name, put in Bogad, those books will come up too.
Well, and since Routledge is mainly an academic press, I have to also tell you how surprised I am that they're even doing your work. And if people have questions for you, or, you know, happen to be in you know, the Sacramento Davis area and want to see what the heck you're doing, is there a way they can get a hold of you, Larry?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I'm based in Berkeley, actually.
Oh, okay.
So. Yeah, so that's closer to San Francisco, et cetera. Yeah, you know, on my website, there's an email contact, and that's the best way to get in touch.
So the Center for Tactical Performance is actually in Berkeley, or is it at UC Davis?
That's right. That's right, and I have a secret for you. It's basically a desk in my apartment. But
hey, you know, who are we pranking now? I want to thank Larry for being with us, and these books were fun to read, but if you think it's all about fun, this was some serious work Larry did, and he makes the points that anybody who's involved in this work can understand. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. We say it loud, we say it on the air, and we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we have another guest, I think about it'll be Larry Kelly on juvenile justice in Arkansas and elsewhere. This has been Wade Rathke for Wade's World, KABF.org, 88.3 FM. Thank you.